I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The new head of the SEC calls it a sad chapter in the history of American business. William Donaldson thus implies that it's over, that we get to turn to a new chapter, a time when the NASDAQ is up again and Wall Street finds integrity. Not so fast, Solomon. The $1.4 billion spanking handed out last week may actually change very little in the manner in which brokers give advice and take the money of investors. A Frontline television documentary that will air this evening on PBS digs further into the Wall Street scandal, and it reminds us just how forthcoming some of the senior players have been. People like Bernie Ebbers appearing before a congressional committee.
Mr. Ebbers, you're the former CEO of WorldCom, is that correct? Mr. Ebbers?
Instruction of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer on the basis of my constitutional rights.
Do you sleep well at night, Mr. Ebbers?
Respectfully decline to answer on the basis of my Fifth Amendment constitutional rights.
Well, many people have already concluded that there's something very wrong with the system and that changes made so far are more cosmetic than substantive. In this hour, we want to look at the way that Wall Street lied and ask, how might it change? Connection listeners, do you have any more faith in the system? Are you thinking about getting back into the stock market? Will the new rules give the individual investor a fighting chance, or are the changes too little, too late? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, before we meet our guest this hour, we're going to hear from one man whose story actually appears in the television documentary. George Michaelis runs a restaurant in Houston. In just over 3 years, George put close to $400,000 into the fast-growing telecom market. He says it was meant to be for his kids' college education. When the prices started slipping, he called his broker at Salomon Smith Barney. He pleaded for some good advice, but the broker told him the firm had the best analyst in the business, that Jack Rubman still loved those stocks. And so George, in Houston, was told to hold on, even as the value of his telecom portfolio dwindled to pennies.
My wife asked me to go to Walgreens. It's about 10 o'clock at night. I'm looking down at the paper. It was the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and I see the name Jack Rubman. I thought, God, I know that name. And I pick up the article and I start to read it. Oh, my God. This is the guy my broker kept telling me about that he would communicate with about these stocks. Here, there's Windstar. That's the stock they told me to buy. And I started reading the story. Well, you know what the story says. He was talking out of two sides of his mouth. He was telling hedge funds in New York, dump it. It's going to go south. He was telling people in Main Street like myself, buy it. It's going to the moon. Well, he was lying to us. I couldn't believe it. The next morning, I march myself up over to the Salomon Smith Barney office. I throw the newspaper on my broker's desk, and I say, what is this all about? Why haven't you told me anything about this? George, calm down, he tells me. You can't believe everything you read. There's a lot of misinformation out there. Things are fine. I said, Bill, I did just fall off some turnip truck, man. I don't have the business acumen you do, but I can smell a rat, and I don't think this is good. I think you guys took me for a ride, and I'm going to want my money back. I said, Billy, you lied to me.
Do you think that the line that you got from the broker was so crooked that, in fact, they do owe you your money back?
Absolutely.
I mean, you and I both know stocks are a gamble, right?
Absolutely. But when a broker tells you that the analyst in New York, Jack Grubman, is working for you, George, and he's working for your kids' college future, and you can rely on this information, I mean, they were flat-out lying. You come to my restaurant, and you order Red Snapper, and I serve you a catfish, let's say by accident, and you bring it to my attention, I'm going to give you your money back. I'm going to apologize profusely. I'm going to invite you back again for another meal. I'm going to honor and respect your business because my integrity is all I have in this business. And so when I wrote my letter to Salomon Smith Barney, I said, I want my money back, not on all my trades. I don't expect that. But on the trades that you specifically lied to me about, on the trades that Jack Grubman said to buy this stock at this time, it's a great buy for your kids' college future. I trusted them, and I put my hard-earned money into that stock at that time.
Did you get a letter back from them, George?
I did get a letter back, and the letter basically said, oh, so sorry you lost all your money. True, we've had some issues with Jack Rubman. We're not going to really get into it in our letter. But, you know, stocks go up and stocks go down, and investing is risky.
Now, you went to see a lawyer in Houston.
I sure did. I hired a securities lawyer. I told him my situation. I presented my paperwork to him, which I kept a tremendous amount of paperwork, all my trades and exchange, what had happened, telephone conversations and notes. He said, George, I would like to represent your children in this case.
What do you think, George? Do you think you'll get your money back? Do you think you'll get any money back?
You know what? I really don't know. I can't believe that in America today, at that level of business, we're talking about the top people in this country and the top financial markets of the entire world, there can be this much crookedness and deceit and lies just out and out, and that they can get away with it with basically what is a slap on the wrist. If that's the way it's supposed to be, how did this happen? How could it happen? I followed the rules. I diversified. I went to a big brokerage house. That's why you pay full-service commissions as opposed to working on Ameritrade. My broker would tell me, listen, that's why you're with us. You get this advice. You get this analysis from our analyst. Many, many occasions I would say, well, who is this Jack Rubman? What is he all about? He'd go, look, he works for us. And because he works for us, he works for you. You're our customer.
Well, we'll stay in touch. And you saved me a seat at the Cleburne, will you?
Thank you, sir.
George Michaelis runs the Cleburne Cafeteria in Houston, Texas. And joining us today, the writer and reporter of this Frontline documentary, Hedrick Smith. He's with us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Here in Boston, Chuck Hill. Chuck worked as a Wall Street analyst for over 20 years. He's now director of research at Thompson First Call, a company that in part analyzes the analysts themselves. So welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Hedrick, a little bit about George Michaelis here. He has a fairly persuasive story to tell.
Well, there are a lot of George Michaelises around the country. We ran into a whole bunch of them. There are thousands who have filed arbitration complaints. Most people probably don't know, but when you sign an agreement with a firm to be your brokerage firm, you sign away the right to file suit. I'd be interested to see how George manages to do it. And you have to go to arbitration, and the arbitration panels are somewhat tilted in favor of the brokerage industry. But there are thousands of those already on the record. The New York State Employees Retirement Fund, California Retirement Fund for State Employees, Florida, Wisconsin, Texas, all across the country. I mean, there are tens of billions of dollars of lawsuits that have been filed by both amateur and individual investors and by professional investors for institutions saying that they were cheated out of their money, not just that the market went down and stocks go up and stocks go down and there's a risk to the market, but that they were actually cheated because they were given false advice. And you do now have the Securities and Exchange Commission, the New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, and a number of other regulators, including Dick Grasso, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, having accused three major New York banks, Citigroup through Salomon Smith Barney, Merrill Lynch, and Credit Suisse First Boston, of fraudulent advice, not just giving bad advice, not just giving misleading advice, but giving fraudulent advice. And what Elliot Spitzer explains in our program, The Wall Street Fix, is what that means is they knowingly gave people advice telling them that certain stocks and certain companies, among them WorldCom, were good when privately the assessment within the firm was the opposite.
Now, Chuck, tell me how you heard the story of George there, because I get stuck between you want to go to the stock market with $400,000, you take your chances, and the explanation that that Hedrick's giving us about, you know, deceit and lies, not just the gamble of the market. How do you hear his story?
Well, I think both the original person there and Hedrick are right. I mean, this is a very typical situation of what went on, and we get it to some extent every business cycle. You get into the frothy period, and a lot of misdeeds creep into the system, and people push the envelope. But then when the market corrects, a lot of self-correction takes place. Some of them maybe didn't realize how far they'd gone and come back to reality. Others there's enough pressure on them that forces them to do it, and we right the ship for the next cycle. The problem this time was twofold. First, the bubble leading up to it was much bigger and longer than in any of the other cycles, so far greater sins were committed, and many more of them. The other problem was that there was some secular issues, some new things that weren't related to the business cycle that happened, and that's related to the conflict issues, where the analysts were under a great deal of pressure from the investment banking side of their firm, from the companies, and even from some of the large investment management institutions.
Now, you're an analyst, not a lawyer, but looking and listening to George's story, do you think he's going to get any money back from Solomon Smith Barney?
I really don't know. I mean, I understand what the rules are, but whether all these cases are going to end up in arbitration or not remains to be seen. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of them go through the court system.
Now, Hedrick, one of the things that you concentrate on in your frontline piece, which is on tonight, is once again, and we've done it, the two of us, on this program before, and I need you to help me with it one more time, and that is exactly what Chuck was talking about, the change in relationship between the analyst, the research, the investment bank, and the investor, the person who's trying to make a little bit of money in the stock market. Can you give me a sort of every man's explanation of what went wrong in that mix?
Yeah, I think what Chuck was talking about, and good morning, Chuck. It's nice to talk to you again.
Likewise.
What Chuck was talking about was the dual role of the analyst. The analyst is sitting there, and back when Chuck was an analyst, and before there were changes in the billing and the allocation of costs and income in the investment business, analysts were basically taking a look at companies, trying to figure out who the winners and losers were, which ones were the smart ones to get in with. And by putting positive reports on certain companies in certain sectors, they were helping direct the flow of capital in the capital markets, money, to new businesses. If the internet was going to be a blowout and was going to be big, it wasn't just making money on the stock market. It's money needed to go into that field to help build the business. The same thing with telecom. Hundreds of billions of dollars were spent laying fiber cable and developing all the hardware that made the system work. And that needs to be done. That's an important and very useful function in American capitalism. And so the analyst, if a pure kind of nerd just studying, that's Arthur Levitt's term, the former Securities Exchange Commission chairman, if they operate like nerds just studying this, they're really helping all of us. They're helping the banks. They're helping investors. They're helping direct wise choices. But what happens is the banks get making so much money helping these companies raise money from their investment banking divisions, mergers and acquisitions, bringing out initial public offerings, helping companies just simply sell their debt. In the case of WorldCom, a bunch of big banks helped WorldCom float $17 billion worth of debt in May 2000 and May 2001 after the company was already going sour. So that's another question.
And then that's big money. The investor ends up dead last, not the priority of the analyst.
That's what happens. The investment analyst is focused on the business and forgets the investor.
All right, Connection listeners, we're talking about the systemic corruption on Wall Street and whether or not it's possible to regulate ethics and whether or not any of the changes announced last week will alter the system there. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. This hour we're discussing Wall Street and the fool's gold it was selling to investors during the tech boom, and whether the $1.4 billion settlement announced last week will actually help get rid of the corruption on Wall Street, and whether your faith in the system has been changed in any way. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me on the program today, Chuck Hill, a 20-year veteran of the market who now works as an analyst looking at the analysts themselves on Wall Street. Hedrick Smith is also with me. He produced a Frontline documentary that tells the story of how one company, WorldCom, rose and fell and brought down millions of investors with it. And there's a part in the documentary where the spinning of stock, the money that is offered to the senior executives at WorldCom through this boutique brokerage set up in L.A. is something that kind of leaves your chin down a little bit. We're going to hear a part now where Hedrick's talking with a former Solomon Smith Barney broker, David Chacon, about that the secret deals that were in place.
Solomon would be able to call these same officers and directors saying, look, I have, 20,000 shares of this company. It's trading at $85 right now, and wanted to give you, the opportunity to invest at the IPO price.
Which is much lower.
$15, $20. It allowed the Solomon Smith Barney to buy people, to buy their decisions, to buy their influence, and to buy their business.
By handing them free money.
By handing them free money.
Now, Hedrick, when Jack Rubman is asked at the Congressional Committee about his own compensation, he says he's making about $20 million a year in these times. His fine is $15 million, which, according to most normal people, would be kind of a frightening sum. But what does it really mean? What's a $15 million fine to Jack Rubman and a lifetime ban?
Well, what's interesting is just, I thought you were going somewhere else with the question. What's interesting is Jack Rubin has also asked whether or not he has anything to do with those IPO allocations
right.
to Bernie Ebers and the other telecom CEOs. And he says, I can't remember. I don't know. I can't remember. You can tell he's been coached by a lawyer. Don't say no, because that'll be a flat out lie and you'll be up for lying before Congress under oath, and don't say yes because you get your company in trouble. The truth of the matter, according to David Chacon and another former Solomon Smith Barney broker we talked to named Phil Spartas, is that Grubman was very much involved in the allocation on a regular basis. In fact, it was Jack Grubman who sent Bernie Ebers to this boutique brokerage in order to get in the line for these IPOs. I mean, so there's no – all of this – was woven together. The real point, it seems to me here, Dick, is that we're going way beyond the analyst. We're into IPOs. Jack Grubman happened to be involved. But even if he wasn't involved, the bank was doing special business kind of under the table with these CEOs. Then you go on and you find out that the Travelers Insurance Company, which is another arm of Citigroup, linked to Solomon Smith Barney, by the way, because the same guy, Michael Carpenter, who was chairman of the board at Travelers, was the CEO of Solomon Smith Barney. So this is a symbiotic relationship here. Travelers gave Bernie Ebers a $1 billion mortgage. Count it, $1 billion mortgage. And he went off and he used some of that money to buy 500,000 acres of timberlands in the southeast. And then he went and bought a ranch in Canada and a boat building company and a lumber yard and ocean-going yachts. I mean, he built a personal business empire. And you say, well, fine, he was a rich guy. He could afford to do that. What's interesting about it was he wasn't selling WorldCom stock. Why not? Because if he'd sold WorldCom stock, it would have been an alarming signal to Wall Street. Hey, the CEO's selling stock. Insiders are selling. Maybe we better get out. So instead of selling stock, they tell him, take a big loan. We'll help you. Well, I mean, they're in bed with each other. And in the end, at least on one of these loans, according to documents that turned up, that we found and other people found, there was WorldCom stock given as collateral to Citibank. Well, that means Citibank, which is another arm of the Citigroup mega bank empire, has a stake in keeping the stock price high in order to cover its loan. And it's got Jack Rubman out there telling the public, telling George Michaelis and everybody else, hey, keep buying the stock. Well, wait a second. None of us got told that they were involved. Then it turns out that Travelers is actually a part owner in Joshua Timberlands, which is Bernie Ebers' private company that owns all these timberlands. Well, wait a minute. They're business partners. They're part owners. And they're selling us the stock. Another part of the business is selling us the stock.
Hedrick,
and
I got to interrupt you here.
Corruption goes way beyond the analyst.
I'm just wondering whether or not you were surprised. You look at this stuff for a living. Were you surprised at
the... I was blown away. I was blown away, Dick. I could not believe it. I had no idea. I'm not a financial reporter. I haven't spent my life here. I've covered all kinds of stuff. And as you know, a year ago, we covered the accounting scandals with Bigger Than Enron, another PBS Frontline show. But I got to tell you, I had no idea this stuff was going on. And the extent of the dishonesty, the extent of the interwoven relationships, the amounts of money. I mean, you just made a point about Jack Grubman. He paid a $15 million fine. I mean, I'd be spending the rest of my life in a salt mine trying to figure out how to do that. Probably my kids and my grandchildren would probably be having to work to do that. Maybe Chuck would have the same problem, and you. Jack Grubman got a $30 million severance package from Citigroup, which, by the way, pays him $200,000 a year right now to be available to Citigroup to work for them in any kind of legal actions they're involved in, such as stockholder suits. So Jack Grubman wound up, you know, with double the severance pay that his fine is.
All right, Chuck.
It's a joke.
Were you as knocked out when the Wall Street Journal and everybody started publishing these stories on how intertwined they were and how much money was flying around?
Well, certainly there were aspects of it, particularly some of this other parts of a firm dealing and having these conflicts. I don't think we realized how extensive that was. I mean, the fact that there was this conflict between the investment banks and the analysts, and that the analysts were not doing the job the way they used to, I think that was pretty well known. But, I mean, some of the parts of the settlement were data released. For example, where some of the firms were paying other firms to provide coverage, research coverage on these companies that the original firm was either bringing public or doing another offering for. I don't think many people in the financial business knew this was going on. And my immediate reaction was, not only was this just plain wrong, but why? I mean, the risk-reward ratio, I mean, you had to figure it was bound to come out sometime. Why did they ever do stuff like this? But I think it was because everybody was so caught up in the emotion of what was going on then. I mean, everything seemed to be okay ethically, but if they'd stopped to think about it, they would have realized that a lot of it was unethical and some of it was just plain dumb.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, come on in on this conversation. We'll start in Durham, North Carolina, and Hugh's on the line. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Sure. I want to say that we ought to look at history on the so-called reform that's taking place for Wall Street and business in general. And history, going back to the 30s, when the SEC was formed, the SEC essentially conceded or defaulted to business as far as oversight was concerned. And if we look, there's been repeated hearings and scandals. We had the Metcalf hearings in 1977. We had the Dingell hearings in 1985.
Hugh, let me get you to jump ahead to where we are right now and whether or not you think what was included in that settlement, any of the rule changes, are going to make a difference.
I don't, and I just want to give you one historical illustration. The SNL scandals, there was $300 billion lost to depositors, and the Big Six paid $6 billion in fine, and we all know what went on after that event. They went back to business as usual. It's my belief, you know, we can pass these laws under pressure, and we can come up with new ethical canons, but I think there's something really wrong culturally. I think that we need to do a real cultural shift and put public interest at least as much a concern as private interest. And until we do that, we're just going to be going through these same events decade after decade.
Hedrick, you on with that?
Well, I think he's got a good point. What he's saying is that back in 1933-34, when the big laws were passed to set up the Securities and Exchange Commission, that largely the commission turned the problem of and the responsibility for regulation over to the stock exchange, to the accounting industry, to various other elements of the industry. And I think we've seen, and Elliot Spitzer keeps saying, the New York Attorney General keeps saying, self-regulation doesn't work. But I think there's a larger point here that he's pointing at. And I think and Chuck was alluding to it. We knew some of these things. When he says we, he means the insiders, because I certainly didn't know the degree to which analysts were corrupted by the interests of the investment bank. But I think there's a larger problem. The problem is that after the collapse of 1929, The Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the securities business from the banking business, the gambling of the market, if you will, from the safe and sound business of putting your deposits in a bank and counting on a low rate of interest but knowing your money was safe. And they said that what had happened was in the 1920s and the collapse of the Depression and so forth, investors had been hurt by having these things combined. What happened in the era of deregulation of the 1990s is that Glass-Steagall was first eroded by a series of decisions by the Federal Reserve Bank under Alan Greenspan to allow banks to get back into the securities business. First 5% of their business, then 10% of their business, then 25% of their business. That wasn't enough for Sandy Weill, the CEO of Citigroup. He wanted to make it even bigger. He wanted to bring insurance in. He went and lobbied in Washington, and he got Greenspan's approval to set up this super bank that's called Citigroup, and then they lobbied Congress. And now you have somebody like Elliot Spitzer saying, look, I can go after the analysts. I can try to deal with that problem. But there's a bigger problem, and we ought to go back and rethink about separating these industries, because the banks are so big, they're into so many fields, that the conflicts of interest are at every corner, and the regulators can't keep up with
them. Well, Chuck, now that the walls are down, can they be reconstructed?
Well, I don't think they can be reconstructed to the height that they should be or that they were 20 years ago unless we address the root causes of the problem. Now, it's easy to throw a lot of blame on the analysts, but they're under tremendous pressures, as I said earlier, from the investment bank side of the house and the companies and so forth. But the settlement is a bunch, as far as this aspect of it goes, is a bunch of thou shalt and thou shalt nots. And that's not how you change the culture.
Well, that's just an excuse to find ways of getting around that, isn't
well,
it?
Well, sure, they get the lawyers involved and they find ways that even though they're not abiding by the spirit of the law, they are legally. But the real problem here between investment banking and the analyst is the fact that the research departments of these firms are no longer economically viable on their own. 20 years ago, they were bringing in enough business from the clients to pay for the research.
I want to try and understand this, so excuse me for interrupting, Chuck, but let's say you are Merrill Lynch and you got some hotshot kid who understands the oil industry top to bottom, refining, exploration. At Merrill Lynch, you're not going to pay him however many hundreds of thousands of dollars he's worth for that straight-ahead research? You're saying that that nobody will pay for this.
Well, that's what's happened. I mean, they drove the and this is why investors, both professionals and individuals, need to look in the mirror here a bit. It's the old story, folks. You get what you pay for. And they kept driving commissions down, down, down to the point that the research department was no longer getting enough commission business for research. So they had to turn elsewhere in the firm, and the obvious place was investment banking.
Where the cash was piled up in the closets.
Right. And once the analysts' compensation started to become significantly from the investment banking side of the house, you had a conflict, and they became beholden to the investment bankers.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Next to Boston, Rob's on the line. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
I'm an ex-analyst, which is sort of like admitting you're a member of the Taliban of Wall Street. But well, I think the, at least in today's press, but I think the pendulum has swung really too far. I think one of the questions that keeps popping into my head is...
Sounds like you're still an analyst, Rob.
Well, you know, it's funny.
Somebody's calling you for advice. I'm sorry. Go ahead. What's your question here?
Here's the question. 13 firms were looked at by Spitzer.
Yeah.
They have somewhere between 50 and 100 analysts apiece. Each of those analysts was involved in IPOs, publishing stuff every day for several years. At least 2 years they were under investigation. Each of those analysts has bankers that are probably one, if not five, bankers assigned to them. So we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people. We're talking about tens of millions of emails, and we've got two people who get SEC charges. Mm-hmm. We've got. And nobody else out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And, you have to. I would ask investors, if it was so fundamentally corrupt, why aren't we seeing more indictments? I can tell you that.
Hang on a sec, Rob. I want to let Chuck hear.
Rob, I mean, you make a good point to start with, and certainly one thing that we shouldn't overlook is that there were some analysts that were doing superb, thorough, unbiased research.
Thank you.
But the problem was there were too few of them.
I totally fundamentally disagree.
Chuck, and you left the business.
I totally fundamentally disagree.
Okay, the indictments are not the only measure. These guys went after a couple of examples, and that's all they were after. They were trying to get enough to force the banks to come around. Elliot Spitzer said something very important, which I think goes to the question you're raising. I said to Spitzer, I said, how will you know if this settlement works? He said, I'll know if this settlement works if we start seeing a bunch of analysts issuing sell recommendations on the companies their banks serve. By that test, it was a disastrous failure among those hundreds of analysts, sir, that you were defending, because there was something like 1% sell recommendations among all the recommendations that all the analysts made in all the industries. In other words, we weren't being given a balanced view by all of those analysts. They were all telling us to buy.
First of all, you're consuming something that you didn't understand. I mean, the fundamental problem with the whole all of research is that most research.
Wait a second, Rob. I'm going to be the dummy here. Yeah. I go to the analyst to explain something to me. So you're accusing me of making a mistake by trying to consume some advice from an analyst who's supposed
analyst.
To be
you're
giving
a retail
recent information.
No. Let's back up a second. You're a retail broker. You're a retail customer. You are not the customer.
Well,
the
whether I get the information through my broker or directly from
would you
some,
pay for it?
Would I pay for it?
Nothing. You pay nothing for it. You aren't the customer. You're consuming something you don't understand. Now, there was a truth in the process that the labeling was not transparent to retail buyers, but it was perfectly transparent to the people it was made to be consumed by, which is institutional customers.
Chuck, let's hear from you on this.
Well, it may be that most of the reports are written for the institutions, and that's certainly what I was doing when I wrote them, because you would go into a lot of depth and so forth. But whether that report or a boiled-down version that someone else created from my report went to the retail person, they were still looking to my judgment and for advice and listening to my recommendations. The professionals don't care about my recommendations, but the individuals do. They're not professionals.
George in Houston sure depended on that sort of advice, at least through his broker. All right, Connection listeners, we're taking a look at the $1.4 billion settlement that was announced last week. It's examined in some detail by a Frontline documentary, which is going to be on PBS tonight, and talking about whether or not the changes announced there will make any difference. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're talking this hour about Wall Street, the way executives and the street got into bed with corporate clients and Connection listeners, wondering whether or not the culture of Wall Street will or has changed, and whether or not you expect it to, whether or not you'd go back into the market. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. With me here in the Boston studio, Chuck Hill, a veteran stock analyst, an expert who has testified numerous times before Congress about conflicts of interest between stock analysts and investment banks. Joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C., Hedrick Smith. He's produced a Frontline documentary about specifically this corruption on Wall Street. It'll be on PBS this evening. Let's go straight back to the phones to Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill's joining us. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Answer to your question, will this make any difference? The answer is not a bit. Look, let's be real here. There was an article in Fortune magazine, and the title of the article was, "They Should Go to Jail." Now, one of the things, it's been a while since I've read the article, by the way, but one of the things that was brought up in the article, a couple of things that were brought up in the article, the chances of any of these people, anyone involved in this kind of fraud, of going to jail is something like around 1%. Let's say I'm off on the figure. Let's say it's 5%, which means that 95% of the people who engage in this sort of thing get away with it. Of those people who are prosecuted, the chances of them going to jail are next to nil. And the few of them that go to jail, maybe they serve 2 years or less. And you're talking also about the fines. No matter how big the fine is, these people still leave with a healthy profit. In this particular case, nobody's going to jail.
So does anything change?
No. It doesn't, and it won't change either. Look, you've got an accounting industry that lobbied to make certain that it can continue to regulate itself. You've got a Congress that will not pass laws that will make these people do hard time. Mm-hmm. They won't even fund the SEC so that it can be up to the prosecutorial standards so that they can follow up on all these cases of corruption. A lot of these cases are settled simply because they don't have the resources to pursue most of them. They're flooded with these cases.
All right, let me turn, if I can, to Hedrick on this one, because you make the point in the documentary, Hedrick, that after the settlement, the door is open to civil suits, to class action suits. But is anybody going to the pokey here?
No. No, and that's the deal. I mean, Eliot Spitzer, it was the – by the way, most of the regulators involved do not have the power to make criminal prosecutions. The Securities and Exchange Commission can only bring civil suits. They can't – it has to be the Department of Justice. Eliot Spitzer has an act in New York law, the Martin Act, which allows him to – criminally prosecute somebody giving fraudulent advice. So he had a choice, and he decided to go for structural reform. But there are other people who say what this gentleman just said, and that is that the money isn't going to be enough deterrent. The $1.4 billion in fines is like postage money to these banking firms. It's like one day's profits. It's not going to make a difference. The only thing that's going to make a difference is if somebody knows that if they do wrong, there's a chance they'll go to jail. By the way, I think George's figures are high. I don't think it's 1% will go to jail. I think it's 0.001% will go to jail. But and I don't know what the numbers are, but they're extraordinarily low. But there are people in the industry, and we quote a portfolio manager from T. Rowe Price at the end of the program saying it's ridiculous that people can get away with this stuff. If there's been a crime, and obviously we're only talking about people who are guilty of crimes. We're not talking about people who give bad investment advice. That is something that all of us have to accept as part of the risk of the business. And the gentleman, the stock analyst, the former stock analyst who called in, is absolutely right about that. But it is important that we get fair advice. And when 99% of the advice is buy, 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 as an investor over the years, I've almost never heard sell advice. It didn't just happen in the 90s. You never get told when to sell stock. It's as important to know when to sell as it is to know when to buy. And that's a serious problem. And when people believe that you ought to be selling, and if, as some people have alleged, that Jack Grubman was privately telling some hedge fund guys to sell and publicly putting out something. And by the way, his stock reports did go through those Salomon Smith Barney brokers all the way down to the retail client, not just George McCullis. We found hundreds of them where that happened. So that advice is not just written for institutional investors.
Chuck buy, right. Sell, hold. Does any of that really mean anything?
Well, it does to the individuals who rely on it.
We thought it was supposed to.
Well, right. I mean, but they did rely on it, and unfortunately, it was extremely biased toward the optimistic side, as Hedrick pointed out. I mean, the rough rule of thumb was that one-third of the recommendations out there would be strong buys or whatever their equivalent terminology was, which is an issue in itself. The second category, buy, was roughly one-third. Hold or neutral was one-third. And then, as Hedrick mentioned, 1% for the sells and strong sells combined. So as an individual investor, you needed to send your box top in to get your secret decoder. Now, the institutions had sent theirs in and understood all this and were able to deal with it. But the individual didn't even know they were supposed to send their box top in to get this two-level decoder, the first to translate all this other terminology. They didn't want to use the word sell, so they came up with underperform or source of funds or all this.
But isn't really your answer the crux of where we are here, that the whether we're talking about this $1.4 billion settlement, whether we're talking about the bubble of the 1990s, that the George Michaelis, the average investor, is never, ever going to be able to play in the market at the level that the institutional investors do because of exactly the kind of intertwining that Hedrick describes in his television piece.
Well, but it didn't used to be that way. I take a little bit of issue with Hedrick on this. There are no statistics available, but there were certainly a lot more sells around 20 years ago. I know I personally put sells on investment banking clients and didn't hear any flack from the investment banking side of the house or the company in those days. And many of my colleagues did the same thing. So it was a very different environment. I mean, there is a rationale to have somewhat of a positive bias because the better companies are going to get more coverage. So there will be more buys out there than sells. But, you know, at the peak of the market in the spring of 2000, the ratio of buys of any kind to sells of any kind was over 100 to 1. That's ludicrous.
Let me tell you a cute little story here about this code that that Chuck is talking about, because it's really interesting. One analyst I talked to said that a strong buy means a buy. This is the code of the analyst to the institutional investor. A buy does not mean buy. A buy means I've got a corporate client here, and I don't want to knock them, but they're not a strong buy. I don't dare put a hold or a neutral or perform along with the market or whatever. I don't dare put anything lower than a buy on them. But a buy is really actually not a good rating. It's actually a bad rating. Then he said a hold is that's an outright sell. You should interpret that as a sell. And if I say underperformer sell, it means the feds are at the door banging. They're confiscating the files. They're about to take things away. You know, we're sitting there talking about this stuff. I said, God, what a laugh. You know, I mean, you know, the hold doesn't mean hold. Hold means jump out the window. And if you get to a sell, it means, you know, the CEO's headed for handcuffs. You know?
You're absolutely right.
it's ridiculous.
But, I mean, the term buy as a category at some firms was the top category. At other firms, it was the second from the top. At others, it was the third from the top, the so-called neutral one, which really meant sell, as you pointed out.
I think when you've got that kind of situation, you've got an enormous amount of confusion at a minimum and fraud at a maximum that you're perpetrating on investors. And the system is set up by insiders for insiders to know the game. And by the way, I've talked about to some of these portfolio managers who are insiders, and they will say, oh, I never paid any attention to Jack Grubman's. Listen to this. I never paid any attention to Jack Grubman's buy or sell recommendations. I knew they didn't mean anything. I was just interested in Jack Grubman's information. He had access to Bernie Ebers and other CEOs that I couldn't get. And so he started telling me about how he used to talk to Jack Grubman every week. Jack Grubman is not just peddling WorldCom and Quest and Global Crossing by his ratings. He's peddling it by his information. When I was a national security reporter, I used to talk to Henry Kissinger on the phone every day before I wrote my article for the New York Times. Henry Kissinger might give me the body count in Vietnam or Walt Rostow or something like that, and I wouldn't pay attention to the body count. But they were selling their policy, and Jack Grubman was selling his stocks even when he wasn't using the buy language. So this selling was going on to institutional investors at a far more sophisticated level, and it was happening just the same. So don't buy this business. I don't buy this business that the insiders knew the code and so they didn't have to worry. Baloney. I know what it's like to work in tight with people who have good information, and they can spin it anytime. Anyway,
all right.
if you're not making your own mind up, you're in trouble.
Let me get back to our phone lines here. I want to go to Louisville, Kentucky next. Charles is on the line. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine, thanks for calling.
Great, thank you for having me on the program. I just a couple comments that I only caught part of the program the last 15 minutes or so, but I guess the basic premise is you asked if things are going to change at all in the market, and I don't think anything's going to change at all. I think it's going to be business as usual. And until they impose some, you know, stringent fiduciary obligations on the people who mismanage people's money in the market, there's really no incentive for there to be any change.
Charles, were you in the market in the 90s?
Yes,
I was. Did you lose money in that market?
I lost a considerable amount of money, and the money that I put in that I, you know, sweated blood to earn, that I sweated blood to pay taxes on, and basically vanished. And there's really zero fiduciary obligation, zero responsibility taken by the people who are supposedly managing, as I say, it's more accurate to say they mismanage your money, and
so
lose your money, and there's no consequences for it. I mean, I'm an attorney, and if I lose a penny of my client's money, there'll be 1,000 of my brethren lining up to rip my throat out, let alone the Bar Association taking my license away.
And what's it going to take, Charles, then, or what would it take to persuade you that risk and, I mean, you know, given the risks of every market, that you'd go back to Wall Street? What would it take?
I will never go back to Wall Street. If I had invested my money in commercial real estate, if I had invested it just in my own practice, I'd be probably retired or semi-retired by now. And, you know, Wall Street's the equivalent of gambling for an individual investor. I think, you know, some of your commentators have said, you know, the institutional people obviously operate on a totally different set of standards and rules and wavelength, and they've got all kinds of insider information that gets passed back and forth, and they act on that. But the average person off the street's got, they might as well play the lottery, and that's really all it is.
Charles, I want to thank you a lot for your call. It's a good perspective. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Chuck Hill, I wonder whether or not the people who are still on Wall Street are worried about the number of people like Charles who are out there saying, no, not me, not again.
Well, I think they are very worried, and we've been heaping a lot of blame out here and taking a dire view of the future. But there are some positive things that are happening. For example, and this is an interesting thing because it's an example of how to regulate as well as something that's working. And that is effective last September 9th, the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers, sat down with a number of the major investment banking houses and came up with a set of rules about these recommendations about what has to be disclosed in their research reports. And as a result, sunlight, you know, is the best disinfectant. And what it meant was that in every report that the firms put out, they had to put what their distributions of buys, holds, and sells are. That means if you're still at 1% sells, and every report is saying this, your clients are going to find out just how much of a shill you've really been. Similarly, they had to say what percent of their investment banking clients were in each category. Obviously, if they were all showing up in the buy category, you're going to look like a shill. And lastly, the analysts had to put in a three-year price chart with their published recommendations and target prices on there. All of this together was a powerful incentive to start saying what you mean and mean what you say. And it has changed. About half of the brokers are now 15 to 35% sells.
Hedrick, are you persuaded?
I got to tell you, I trust Chuck, and I trust his numbers. And if Chuck tells me they're 15% sells, I'm going to say two things. Number one, that's an enormous change. And number two, it's a bad market. But wait till the market starts back up again, and I want to see if it stays. Chuck, if it stays, I think you're right. I mean, that is at least one of the things that had to be done, and I think there was a serious effort to write rules. The difficulty is we've had pretty good rules for a long time, and we've had this problem. I just don't trust self-regulation. I think that there's got to be more legislation enacted and stiffer penalties.
All right, Hedrick, thanks for your time on the program today.
Thank you.
Hedrick Smith, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, producer of The Wall Street Fix, a Frontline documentary that airs tonight on PBS. Chuck Hill, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Chuck's director of research at Thompson First Call, a veteran of Wall Street. We heard earlier in the program from George Michaelis, owner of the Cleburne Cafeteria in Houston, Texas. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.